Here is Bung. It's her first time away from home. First plane trip. She is wide-eyed and clutching her mum's hand, stepping onto the tarmac and into a new life. Australia is nothing like Thailand. The houses are bigger and everything is strange. New people, new school, a new language. The rice paddies and dense green vegetation of home has been replaced with bitumen roads and suburban streets with brick houses and endless expanses of neatly trimmed lawn. Bung is nervous about fitting in. She's worried she'll miss the family members she's left behind. The world is suddenly very large, and Bung is still very small. But she's excited too.
There's a hole in my heart the size of an island. There's a hole in my heart the size of an island. Islands can be big and small, my love, for you will never go away.
In early June 2011, Sirigon Siriboon, affectionately known by her nickname Bung, was a happy and bright 13-year-old halfway through her first year of high school. The previous few years had been full of change and adjustment, but Bung showed great resilience and faced each challenge head-on. She was born in Thailand on December 30, 1997, and had an older sister, Siriporn, whose nickname, Pang, complemented her own. The sisters' parents divorced when both girls were still young. In 2004, their mother, Vanita, travelled to Melbourne for a holiday and fell in love with a local named Fred Patterson. The pair stayed in touch after Vanita returned home, and 2 years later, Fred moved to Thailand. The couple married, and Fred became a loving father to Bung and Pang. In 2008, the family decided to move to Melbourne so that Pang, now 17, and Bung, aged 10, could have the advantage of an Australian education. They purchased a home in the eastern suburb of Boronia, and the girls settled in. Pang completed the equivalent of a high school education, while Bung took English classes and attended the local primary school. She soon became best friends with a classmate named Diami Hillard, who also lived in the area. Diami was often bullied by other students, but Bung always stood up for her. When it was time for the two friends to start high school several years later, they both enrolled at Boronia Heights College. They met each morning to walk to school, then ambled home together in the afternoon. The 850-metre long route along residential streets only took about 10 minutes to complete.
Here is Bung. Why has everyone put their furniture out on the street? She asks. Her dad, Fred, explains about rubbish. It seems ridiculous when he says it out loud. Where Bung and her family come from, everything is reused. Every last scrap of paper, every empty tin. Bung is fascinated. Can we go and look? They spend a morning wandering the footpaths of Boronia, glimpsing into the lives of others, wondering why such useful-looking things have been discarded. They see sagging chairs and old TVs and dented bicycles and plastic children's toys. Fred feels a bit guilty to see it all, to realise how much we take for granted. But Bung is too young and innocent for cynical thoughts. She is a detective, an anthropologist, a treasure hunter. It's a peculiar family outing, but for Bung, everything is an adventure. Bung plants flowers in the front garden of her new house with her mum, sister and dad. They install a water fountain. Magpies warble above them in the twisting white arms of gums, and the house starts to feel like home.
It was raining on the morning of Thursday, June 2, 2011. Bung ate egg rice soup for breakfast, then set off for school at around 8:30. Calling out, "Bye, Mum, see you later," as she left. The army was being driven that day due to the weather, but Bung was content to walk. She was wearing her school uniform, a dress with blue and white stripes, as well as black Dunlop Volley runners, white socks, a blue raincoat, and a blue patterned backpack. A neighbour who lived three doors down on Elsie Street saw her walking her regular route shortly after 8:30. But when her teacher took roll call minutes later, there was no sign of Bung. Nor did she attend any of her other classes throughout the day. Though Bung's absence was unusual and immediately noticed by both friends and teachers, it was assumed that she was unwell, and nobody followed up the matter with her family. Bung typically returned home from school by 3:40 p.m., but that afternoon, there was no sign of her. She had left her mobile phone at home in accordance with school rules, and shortly after 4 o'clock, just as Vanita was starting to wonder where her daughter was, the phone rang. It was Bung's best friend, Diami, calling to remind Bung about a football game they were scheduled to play the following day. Diami told Fred and Vanita that Bung hadn't been at school, and panic immediately set in. The couple drove directly to Baronia Heights College and spoke with the school principal, who confirmed that Bung had been absent, and staff had assumed she was sick. After quickly searching the school grounds, Fred and Vanita drove to Knox Police Station to report their daughter missing. Police took a statement from them, but were unable to do anything further as Bung hadn't been missing for long. They advised the couple to reach out to all of their family and friends to ensure Bung wasn't with someone else. Fred and Vanita called and visited all of Bung's friends, but no one had seen her. Diami informed them that her mother had driven her to school that morning because of the rain. They had stopped briefly at the girls' regular meeting spot, hoping to offer Bung a lift, but hadn't seen her. Fred and Vanita were so distraught that they couldn't eat or sleep that night. Early the next morning, they returned to the police station to officially report Bung missing, and detectives took up the case. The couple then searched the local streets, malls, and parks, door-knocking the area and distributing missing person posters that featured a photo of Bung, smiling and dressed in her school uniform. Fred took leave from work so he could spend all of his time searching for Bung. By late afternoon, on Friday, June 3, the press had gotten hold of the story and Bung's family were fronting the media. Fred made a public plea for information, stressing that it was completely out of character for Bung to disappear, as she was a happy child who enjoyed school and liked staying close to home. Over the weekend, Fred, Vanita, and Pang kept searching, while family and friends rallied around them, providing meals and getting the word out on social media. Police hoped that Bung had merely gone off with a friend and was now scared to return home for fear of punishment, but told the media that they were not ruling out a possible abduction. Due to the significant publicity the case was receiving, tips started flooding in, but no concrete leads emerged.
Here is Bung. Fred cuts his finger on a kitchen knife. Bung's older sister squeals at the sight of blood and races from the room. But Bung comes over, her face unusually serious. "Are you okay?" she asks. Fred assures her that he is fine, but Bung isn't convinced. She collects disinfectant and band-aids and insists on administering them to the wounded finger. Bung loves to look after people. Maybe she'll be a doctor one day, if she doesn't become a pop star. Maybe she'll be both. When she's assigned a younger buddy at school, she takes on the responsibility with enormous gravity and pride. She remembers that not so long ago, she was a new person, shy and worried about fitting in. She notices the outsiders, keeps an eye on them. She knows what it feels like to be different. People look at her and see a confident, happy Australian kid. They don't realise how hard she's worked to fit in, to learn English, to make friends. Bung makes it look easy.
By the end of June, Melbourne's homicide squad took over the case, being far better resource to investigate and sift through information. Though Bung's family was assured that this did not mean police believed she was dead, it was confirmed that the squad was officially treating Bung's disappearance as an abduction. Over the months that followed, homicide detectives door-knocked hundreds of homes and tracked down tradespeople, couriers, and other non-locals who had been in Boronia on the day of Bung's disappearance. They examined CCTV footage and questioned known sex offenders living in the area. Bung's social media accounts were studied in the hopes that they might offer some clues, but nothing indicated she had been communicating with anyone suspicious. As those close to a victim are typically the first suspects, detectives also focused on Bung's family, in particular, her father, Fred. The family residence in Elsie Street was thoroughly searched, with police even looking beneath the house after it was reported that Fred had been digging near the foundations. Inquiries were made regarding Bung's birth father back in Thailand, but no leads resulted, and Bung's entire family were cleared as suspects. The trauma and strain began to take a severe toll on Bung's loved ones. Fred had taken time off work, but had to return in early July. Vanita, struggling with living in the area where her daughter had been taken, returned briefly to Thailand, where she was supported by relatives, and visited Buddhist temples to pray. Bung's best friend, Diami, was deeply affected by Bung's disappearance, and the added stress of being constantly followed by reporters led her to relocate to Byron Bay in New South Wales to live with her father. Many students from Boronia Heights College sought out counselling services, and few children walked to and from school anymore, with frightened parents opting to drive them instead. On October 25, 2011, more than 4 months since Bung's disappearance, Victoria Police announced the launch of a special task force devoted entirely to investigating her abduction. Dubbed Task Force Puma, it was staffed by 12 full-time detectives and a tactical intelligence officer. The new team set about interviewing and re-interviewing more than 450 individuals whose homes or businesses were situated between Bung's house and Boronia Heights College, then worked outwards into the local area. Like the homicide squad, they reviewed CCTV footage and looked into sex offenders residing in the area. Yet, still no solid leads emerged.
Here is Bung. She's dancing barefoot on the beach in Port Arlington, drawing pictures in the damp sand with a stick of driftwood. It's overcast and grey, wind kicking up the occasional gust of stinging sand and whipping the usually calm water into white-topped wavelets. But Bung isn't going to let a cool day prevent her from swimming. She'll go in, feel the fizz of the waves, the grit of sand between her toes. She poses for a photo, fingers splayed in peace symbols. Bracelets twine around her wrists and her black hair drifts across her face, tossed by the ocean breeze. Later, they'll have dinner with her grandparents, Fred's parents, who are nothing but charmed by this inquisitive, energetic little girl who wears her heart on her sleeve. They feel lucky to have her in their lives, and she feels the same way. On a different holiday, Fred takes them to the mountains and Bung's eyes grow as wide as saucers. She's never been to the snow before. She catches snowflakes on her tongue and makes snow angels and throws snowballs, and it feels like the most magical place in the world.
1 year on from Bung's disappearance, police publicly appealed for information, as did her father, Fred Patterson, who said on camera, "If she can see this or if somebody is with her, send her home. It's time now. The family misses her. We love you, Bung. We want you home." Fred and Vanita were still hopeful that Bung would return. Both devout Buddhists, they told the media that they had consulted with monks and healers in Thailand who had advised them that she was still alive. The family and the police continued to appeal to the public for information, but it would be another 12 months until there was a significant development. In August 2013, A 24-year-old man contacted police, claiming that he had been driving in Boronia on the morning of June 2, 2011, and accidentally hit and killed Bung as she walked to school. He said that upon realising Bung was dead, he panicked and buried her body in a nearby reserve called Old Joe's Creek Retarding Basin, which was less than 2 kilometres from Bung's home. The man was placed under arrest, his car was seized, and police organised a search of the reserve, which spans 22,000 square metres and includes areas of dense bushland. Over 3 days, Task Force Puma detectives, state emergency services members and cadaver dogs searched the parkland, but nothing connected to Bung was ever found. The 24-year-old was subsequently released as police found no evidence to support his claims. 2 months later, he was rearrested and re-interviewed, but was again let go as elements of his story didn't add up. On Friday, October 25, 2013, it was announced that Task Force Puma was being dismantled, based on a recommendation from Victoria Police's Crime Command. Though police said there were still several active lines of inquiry and persons of interest in the case, including the man who claimed he'd killed Bung with his car, they refused to comment further. By the time the task force was disbanded, police had interviewed more than 250 registered sex offenders, searched over 1,000 homes and businesses, and investigated more than 1,100 pieces of information provided by the public. Several months later, on Tuesday, February 4, 2014, Fred and Vanita Patterson held a press conference alongside homicide detectives to again beg for their daughter's return. Though police were no longer holding out much hope of Bung's survival, Fred said that the family still believed she was alive. Detectives then announced a $1 million reward and immunity from prosecution for information about Bung's disappearance.
Here is Bung. She's singing and dancing in the back room of her house with a friend. They play the same K-pop song over and over and over, perfecting their dance routine until every twist and bend flows perfectly in time to the music. Once they get it right, they'll film it for posterity and then pore over it, analysing every frame for flaws. Later on, they might walk down the street to Macca's. They'll talk about all the things teenagers talk about, homework and friends, hopes and wishes. High school is still a novelty, and there is so much to look forward to. Bung loves to move, and there are athletics tournaments and football matches coming up. The Rockerstedford is right around the corner, and Bung can't wait to dance in front of a crowd, feel the adrenaline of live performance. But before any of that can happen, they have to focus on their dance routine. Bung has always loved music. She's tried to learn instruments, had guitar lessons for a while, but it wasn't her thing. Then she discovered K-pop, and it was like her life became a little more complete. K-pop is everything to Bung. She's teaching herself Korean. One day she's going to go to Korea, meet her idols, maybe show them some of her dance routines. Her heart races in time to the beat.
On the third anniversary of Bung's disappearance, police revealed new information that they'd received some time ago in the hopes of generating fresh leads. On the morning that Bung went missing, a witness had supposedly seen a young Asian girl in the back seat of a white Ford Falcon station wagon. The girl was described as wearing a light-coloured shirt and dark blue V-neck jumper, while the driver of the car was a man aged in his late 50s to early 60s, dressed in a blue singlet. He was fair-skinned with light brown hair combed back into a rock and roll greaser style and had a colourful tattoo on his upper left arm. The witness told police that she instinctively felt there was something odd about the situation. Investigators took the report seriously, although the description did not match any of the known persons of interest or their vehicles. By June 2016, Bung had been missing for 5 years, and still her family had no answers. Trying again to encourage new information, police released the details from another witness statement which had been made in the first few days after Bung disappeared. The witness reported seeing a teenage girl of Asian appearance sitting in the front seat of a white station wagon on Napoleon Road in Roeville, roughly 11 kilometres from Boronia, between 8:45 and 9 a.m. on the morning of Bung's disappearance. The car's rear seats were folded down, and the driver was described as a Caucasian male aged in his late 30s to early 40s. He was either bald or had light-coloured hair, with sleeve tattoos on both arms and a large tattoo on the left side of his neck. Police also released photographs of a white station wagon similar to the one described by the witness. Despite hopes that these reports would bring new information to light, neither of them ever generated any leads. As of March 2020, the case remains unsolved. Bung's mother, Vanita, has since moved back to Thailand but returns for holidays, while Bung's sister, Pang, graduated from Swinburne University with an international business degree. Her father, Fred, still lives in the house on Elsie Street in Boronia. Bung would have turned 22 years old in December 2019. Victoria Police are still offering a $1 million reward for information leading to a conviction.
Fred will join me in the studio after this word from our sponsors. And now Fred joins us in the studio for a conversation about his daughter's disappearance. Firstly, I just want to say, Fred, I'm so sorry that Bung is still missing. I can't imagine how devastating it has been for you and your family. So thank you so much for coming in and being open to sharing your experience with us.
Yeah, that's good. It's fine. I feel like I've got to do something. You've spent so much time and effort.
It means a lot. I think so many people will relate to so many aspects of this that haven't really had a chance to get airtime in the past. When families find themselves in this awful situation that no one's ever ready to find themselves in, people vanishing is just not something that we're ever expecting to happen in life. All of a sudden, you're extremely vulnerable and it's very public, and you are thrust in front of different sort of key groups, I think. There's police, obviously, there's the media, and then there's the public that also kind of feel entitled to know about your grief. So I think the first one of those being police in your situation. I'm curious to hear about your experience with police from the very beginning when Bung first disappeared.
Well, from the onset, the very first hour or couple of hours when we found out, the police were okay. They were, you know, weren't over excited about what was going on. Went down to the local station and made a statement, or, you know, told her that our daughter wasn't at home and didn't come home, and they sort of took it in their stride, but I don't know, it's a long time ago that I don't have a complete memory of it, but it was, we'll check with all the friends and see if she hasn't just showed up, and, you know, if you've got worries afterwards, then come back and make a statement sort of thing, you know. Wouldn't have been there if we weren't worried at the start, so it could have probably been handled differently, but at that time you're in that sort of fog of what to do, where to go, you know, what's happening. It's search before, you know, ask questions and things like that. So.
But this is a child. Yeah. Bung was a child, and you would expect from police there to be a lot more urgency around that.
Well, you would think so, but she's also a teenage child, and sometimes they go and see their friends. Sometimes they, you know, don't do exactly what they're supposed to do or whatever. So I can sort of see what the problem was, but not as well. You know, the school didn't seem overly concerned at the start when I first mentioned that she hadn't showed up, and they said, yes, we'll check everywhere, but we're pretty sure she hadn't showed up. And So, yeah, and at that time, it's, you don't have a lot of time to stop and gather your thoughts. You're just in
sort of
panic mode.
Yeah. But, I mean, she hadn't done anything like that before, had she?
No.
So it was out of character.
Yeah, it was very out of character, and it was that was the reason we got on straight away, when we realised that she hadn't been at school, and her friend called up and, you know, tell Bung what's going on tomorrow, and that's sort of when everything sort of fell out.
And so the police, when you first went, you made the statement and they said that they couldn't really do anything further because it hadn't been long enough. I think there's this idea, and it's absolutely a myth, at least in Australia, that you have to wait a certain amount of time. People think that you've got to wait 24 hours to report someone missing. That's not the case.
Yeah.
As soon as you have concern for someone's welfare and their whereabouts are unknown, regardless of the demographics, the situation, you can report them missing, and that's so important that people know that.
Yeah, for sure. And that's, you know, as you say, people think it's, you know, you have to wait a certain time, but no, it's and I know that certainly for now, and I didn't even think about that at the time. You know, it was, we're down, we're reporting, with let, you know, information go. Now we've got to get out. I haven't got time to sit here and talk to you. I've got to get out and find my daughter. So we were straight away running around friends, places we knew, you know, trying contacts, calling people. As you don't have all your friends' kids' numbers, you don't have all your friends' parents' numbers, you don't know everyone, you know. So it was a pretty hectic time walking streets and no sleeping.
That's it. You're not sleeping, you're not eating, you're not thinking clearly. And you kind of expect that when this type of thing happens, you go to the police and they are going to sort of take care of it and help you through that process. Were you guys assigned one officer in the beginning that's kind of maintained the contact between, you know, the family these 9 years, or has it kind of moved around? Or?
Well, the initial was just reporting to the local constable at the local shop, you know, over the counter. There's no one there, you know, who's directly involved in it. It was pretty quick that we were given a senior sergeant from the Knox Crime Authority. They were onto it, I think, within a day or so. I can't exactly remember, but that was pretty quick. And yeah, so we were interviewed by a certain sergeant, and he had taken control of us and the family for a week or so until it got handed over to Justin Tipp. It was the main, he's been the main man ever since. He's been my point of contact for a good on 8 years.
This whole context is extremely uncomfortable, but I do have a particularly uncomfortable question to ask around the fact that police did, as is pretty standard, I acknowledge, and that therefore I think a lot of people will relate to this, but they looked to you as a possible suspect in the early stages.
Well, when you look at past history and news and people, that's a fair chance that it's happened, and it's happened a lot. At the time, I had no concern about them investigating me. I knew I had nothing to do with it. I had nothing to hide. Yeah, I was getting asked, and then there was rumours going around schools and people saying stuff on media that I stopped looking at altogether. There was, you know, articles popping up and things like that. But, yeah, I guess they have to start somewhere because there was nothing, and the easiest or closest is to start the circle in the middle and work its way out. So, yeah, I accepted that I was a suspect, but I knew I had nothing to hide. So good or bad, you know, it's got to be done, I guess.
Yeah, I can understand that. But how does it impact your identity? So you're walking around the streets and people that you're maybe socialising with, friends or colleagues, did you notice any behaviours kind of change at that time?
Looking back at it, all my mates and stuff stuck by me. I don't have a lot of associates, a lot of, you know, people that I call friends. So if they were talking, I had no sort of interest or direct contact with that. The people that were in my circle were all stuck by me. I don't think I heard anyone say, oh, it could have been, you know, what do you think about Fred? Was it, you think he did something? I never really copped that. I never really got in, you know, got accused of that from the people I knew or my friends.
Good, because I think that on top of everything that's going on, like that's the last thing that someone like you needs, but it does happen. Yeah. And you can understand why. But
yeah, well, it may have happened from Bung's friends' parents and Bung's friends' acquaintances, but as I say, we didn't have a major big circle of friends or, yeah, we were sort of pretty close-knit sort of family and friend circle. So there was different rumours that you hear and, yeah, but it was nothing that I took to heart.
What's your rapport been like with the police from the get-go? I mean, it changed hands pretty early on, you said, and has it been a, I mean, it's a difficult relationship to navigate, but has there been a good rapport?
It has been. Well, it's taken over a few lives. It's, at the start, Sergeant Rowan, his name was, and he was very supportive. He was in the crime squad rather than the homicide squad so much. So he was very supportive and helpful and, you know, sort of, but he only lasted a week or so before they moved it on to the next department. And at the start, it was Justin Tippett, who was a professional detective. At the start, it was very good. He was trying to keep me informed with everything that was going on. The whole thing, they can't tell you everything. They can't tell you what they're going on because they're searching through things. So, yeah, the first couple of years, it was pretty full on with media and things like that. In the end, it's like they're searching for something like a needle in a haystack. They've got nothing. So the communication between the police and me and the family has died off a lot. It's been 8 years. I don't guess they can ring up every family every week to say, we've got nothing. We've got nothing new. There might be an article come up or something come up in the missing week, a missing persons week, or another something pops up on social media or something. And I'll give him a call or something. Over the time, I've had different people come out of the blue and say, what about this? Have you thought about this? And mention names and stuff like that. So I've got straight on to Justin and said, do you know about this? I've had this guy ring me up, or I've had this guy drop around, or say he's been investigating himself and things like that. So things like that out of the blue, I've reported on to Justin. And most of it he's known about it. Some of it he hasn't, but he has followed it up and things like that. But as I say, for the last year or so, maybe even more, it's, you know, once every 3 months or once, you know, missing person weeks or something comes up and they ask what's going on. And I say, well, this year we're not doing anything about it. Last year we did. And I always ask, are they still actively involved in a case, still actively going through data? He informs me that, yeah, they still, amazingly so, they still get phone calls through Crime Stoppers. A lot of the stuff is the stuff that they've heard before, but it was quite strange that people were still calling up every other week or every other month about some bit of information. So, yeah, the rapport with the police has been, yeah, okay, I guess. But, yeah, what can you tell someone if you don't know any?
Well, communication is really important. I think a lot of families of long-term missing people still want that contact from police, even if there is no new information. They still want to know that there's no new information.
Yeah,
just to show them that they haven't forgotten about their loved one and they're still, you know, it's still active, because when it does trail off, when years go by, you do start to feel more and more isolated from that kind of help. And I think a lot of people in this situation, because police are the first point of contact, you've got to report your loved one missing, you worry about, I know myself, I worried about, you know, being critical of police. And so I always felt that I had to bite my tongue over the years based typically on inaction. We have very different cases, you and I. And I think a lot of families do feel that they've got to bite their tongue because they're fearful that if they do criticise police, they won't have their help when they need the police. And that's going to vary depending on the type of case, of course. But I think a lot of families do worry about ever airing any complaints because you still feel like you need the police. Like, this is an investigation.
Yeah, yeah. Getting angry and accusing and blaming. It doesn't really help. It gets you upset. Yeah, it'd be, you know, jump up and down and scream and say, listen, what's going on? My situation, our situation, the way everything's panning out, try not to get frustrated. Nothing's perfect in this world, and we could go into the politics and the hand ties and who can do what and what information and compare it to my other home or compare it to Thailand, how things are done over there. Yeah, they're done differently, but we want it both ways. We want our freedom and our privacy, but we also want answers, and we want other people's freedoms and things taken so we can find out what we know. So it's very difficult, but going to the whole situation of the Australian government and the way things are run in this country and, you know, the freedoms and the non-freedoms, I try not to get bogged down by that.
It's impressive that you're able to see all the sides and be as at peace as one can be with this situation.
Yeah, well, sometimes it's not like that, but I'm not a sort of person that explodes up in public. If I yell at someone, I yell at myself usually.
Therapeutic, yeah. One of the other groups, a necessary evil, is media. You know, you're in this situation where you need the public to be aware, and naturally the media is a vehicle for that. What's your experience been like with the media?
Well, there's been good, great and bad, just you know, completely irresponsible and wrong as well. A lot of the media that had been put out on through the web and the internet and things, I just didn't look at, didn't research, didn't get back up. Every now and again I'd have a look. But, yeah, there was some people just trying to get a story, some people just trying to, not very personal at all, but on the other hand, I've had reporters and yourself treat me as a human, just wanting to keep the story in the media, not coming out with, you know, this could have happened or this is what's happening or we've heard a rumour from here, or just blatant false truth. As I say, a lot of it I didn't see, but I've had other friends say, did you see that? And I said, no, I didn't see things. As you say, the media is a necessary evil that we need, and there are good reporters and good, you know, people in there, but there's also the ones that are just, you know, looking for ratings and things like that. So it's been a mixed bag. But on the most, I think I've had a pretty good result with the situation that's been, the subject matter and stuff, you know, missing child. I think most of them have been pretty sensitive to the situations and done really good releases and articles and things like that. Some of the stories on the news and on the TV, I think the Current Affair did a fairly in-depth one, which was I believe was done really well. People haven't really been hassling. At the time, earlier on, there was knocks on the door and, you know, all times and sort of ambushes as I was walking out the house. But you know, that was just to get some story. But as time went on, I still get a couple of different news agencies ring me up on the anniversary. Is there anything you've found out? Is there anything you want us to do? Want to do another expose about you? So maybe there's more that could be done. I don't know what's more that we can. You can only, I guess, keep going over the one story again and again without any new information coming in. But as long as people still know what's going on and still think that it's not over and still understand that this thing's ongoing.
Absolutely. And that's the thing. It is ongoing. Fung is still missing. She still needs to be found. And with that comes the continued obligation, I guess, that you feel to tell that story over and over. And that's got to be exhausting to feel that obligation.
Yeah, sometimes, you know, I still bump into people who don't know the story. There's still a lot of people that don't look at media or newspapers or, you know, or then I'll bump into other people and say, oh, I remember that girl. Well, that's my daughter. And then it brings up a whole different situation. So, yeah, we can only live in hope and wait for an outcome. I'd like to be able to get a magic wand and a magic crystal ball and find out what's going on, but somebody's got to know something. Somebody's out there who knew or knows what happened. Enough wishes or enough hope in the world might get that person to come forward. Who knows?
How do you maintain hope? Because it is kind of in this situation, like kind of a lot of the time, the thing you feel is the only thing that exists to keep you getting out of bed each day. I know that that was the case for us, was that there is always hope. What's your relationship with hope like?
Well, to say my beliefs and what I believe in, some of the things I've seen, experienced in my life, things happen, it's unexplainable things that happen. There's no evidence, there's no sign of if she's not here or if she's here. There's nothing. So you can't assume, you can't make up. At the moment, we can just hope and believe in what we've been told by certain people, by certain mediums or monks. It all depends on your life and what you believe in. Believe in reincarnation, believe in nothing, you know, what you've experienced. So it's not easy, and sometimes you do question yourself whether, well, just give up on it or give up on her or give up on whatever, but you can't do that because we don't know. You can't say, well, this is the way it is, because you don't know. We keep going through it. We live our lives. We do what we can. And she's always in our minds, in the background, but not at the forefront. It's not something you sit and dwell on day after day. Walk past her photo in the morning, yep, say hello. Sometimes think, when are you coming home? It's not easy, but I say life's not easy. It's what you have to go through. Everyone has to go through something, and it's just that we're sort of cop this to do.
You're very strong to be able to look at it like that. I think a lot of people do kind of go to, it could be worse, but that certainly does not diminish the fact that you are living any parent's worst nightmare day in, day out. Mm. Do you think that your religion helps?
Oh, I don't think it's the religion. I think it's beliefs more than calling something a religion gives it a label. Our beliefs match up with a certain sector of life or whatever. Yeah, that's beliefs in what I believe in life and afterlife, and everything happens for a reason. We're on a journey that's supposed to happen when it happens, and unexplainable things. So, yeah, it definitely helps us get through. Death, is part of life. We're all going to be there. We're all going to go through it. Depends on the journey, how we get there. So at the moment, this is what we've got to go through. It's very easy to go down a dark path and sit in the bottom of a cave and try to get out and blame the world or ask why is you go mad. As you say, there is other people in the world who've got other problems who are probably worse or not as bad. Or I'm still one of the lucky ones that can wake up in the morning, take a breath and get up and walk and go somewhere and do something. At the moment, something's been taken away from us, out of our control, but there's no use trying to get upset about that there's something out of our control.
So incredible that you're able to have that mentality, because you do feel absolutely stripped of all power and control when this happens, and you are left with often an overwhelming sense of hopelessness and helplessness, and as if nothing is going to fix it. And I guess you don't get, it's not one of those types of losses that gets easier to bear over time, because it is ambiguous loss, and we know that that's just not the case with this, because it's not traditional bereavement. There is nothing to say that Bung's not coming back. So there is always that hope, but there's that despair with that hope.
Yeah, if someone dies and you've got a coffin and you can say goodbye, you know it's over, you know it's done. That's part of the healing, that's part of the progression, that's the way it is. When somebody goes missing, completely vanishes off the face of the earth, and nobody knows anything, nobody's seen anything. Yeah, it's a difficult thing to deal with, and it doesn't get easier, but you get better at dealing with it.
Absolutely. You do become increasingly resilient, I think. You can. Some people can, others might not. It is interesting, that idea around the natural order, and yes, people die. Everyone knows that. Death and taxes, unavoidable. But this isn't that. This isn't death. So have you and your family considered or done any sort of equivalent, you know, ceremony? Some families like to have memorial of sorts. Others want to completely avoid that idea altogether.
Well, there's no need or no opportunity to have a memorial, because we still believe that she still is around somewhere. So we don't have a ceremony. It's her birthday. We say happy birthday. It's Christmas time. You know, we think about where she is, or sometimes, you know, you put the energy out into the universe. That's what a lot of people do. Birthdays and things, you go to the temple and pray and make some respects, you know. But as for a memorial service or a dedicated thing, no, we try to keep going on as we're going on. When there's an occasion that's her birthday, or, you know, Christmas time or something like that, yeah, we'll go to the temple and do something. But we do that for everyone's birthday. We do that for Mum's birthday. Parents that have died, respect them on their birthday. It's the same sort of thing. So, yeah, we keep going on like that, and sometimes we'll sit down and discuss, and Needle ask me, has Justin spoken to you, or is this done? So she'll ask every now and again if I've rang to find out what's going on or things like that. But it's an everyday-to-day thing. We go along with our lives, and yeah.
Those days like birthdays and, you know, holidays and anniversaries are particularly difficult for families in this situation. So is that kind of like the only time that you and Nid discuss openly what you think might have happened, or where might Bung be on this day? I mean, because you are forced to spend that whole day thinking about your loved one, and it's awful. It's so difficult.
Well, I don't think so that it's left up to any certain day that we discuss things like that. Or, and the situation where I'm in, I live in Australia, she lives in Thailand, daughter lives with me, we're all very busy in with our own lives, and, you know, try not to focus on the point. You know, a birthday will come up, then, as I say, go to the temple, make some respect, but the conversation of keep coming up, what's happened. It'll come up every now and again, but it won't come up on a specific date or a specific time. You know, it's just we miss her and things like that. So every year is different. You know, I don't know what's going to happen in the next 1 year, 2 years, 10 years. Hopefully something comes up positive.
Do you think milestones are harder than other ones? Because it would have been Bung's 21st birthday.
Yeah, milestones and things like that. And as I say, you can dwell on that, you know. Would have been 21. 21 is just another birthday. Mm. We're not overly, you know, 16, 21, 40, 50. And in the end of the day, it's just another day. And as you get older, I think you probably enjoy spending that day by yourself more than you do with a whole lot of people.
But, true, yes.
but Yeah. Anniversaries. I don't like to say the word. It's the anniversary of her going missing. It's the anniversary of it. It's not an anniversary. It's a day that she's still not home. A day that we still don't know what's going on. It's not just because, oh, it's, you know, 12 months or 8 years or on the day. It does make it difficult because other people want to know. There's other people want to be informed on that specific day. We live with this. So a specific day or a holiday or an anniversary, you know, there's been a lot of people or a few people that she loved and loved her have passed on since she's been missing. So that sometimes is sad as well. There's my mother, her grandfather on the Thai side. They all loved her so much and haven't had the opportunity to see her come back. That can be distressing sometimes, things like that.
Is that your greatest fear for you and Ned?
Not to see her before we go. Could be. I don't know what our greatest fears are. We have different ones. If it comes to that, will I see her again on the other side? Yeah, maybe. I believe in we have spirits that go on at the moment. Yes, I do. But once again, I don't believe that she's passed on. So, you know, it's only chance or a matter of time, or I try not to dwell on those sort of ideas or have greatest fears that this is not going to happen. It's very difficult to do, but there's no use worrying about anything really, because worrying doesn't fix anything. It's a very hard concept, but I'm getting better at it lately than I was before. Giving something worry and worrying if you're going to be able to pay the bills next week, worrying if you're not going to, you know, do this, or worry if you're going to catch a corona, or worry about this. Why worry about it? It hasn't happened. When it does happen, deal with it. You don't have to worry about it. So, yeah, sometimes there's some, I guess, some regrets or worry. I don't know how you'd explain it. But, yeah, we don't say, oh, geez, I hope I see you before I die. That's never been. Mm. You know.
That's, I think, certainly many people that have been involved in this podcast have expressed that kind of concern that, you know, because time is passing, like some families have been living this hell for decades, and the thought of not knowing when you die, like I remember when Dan was missing and Mum said to me, I don't want to die not knowing, but I don't want to know if he's no longer alive. So that's impossible. But people do fixate on that notion because we're just not comfortable as humans to not know things. Like uncertainty is not something that we're very good at dealing with, so.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of that with the human nature that they need to know what's going on. As I say, my lifestyle and where I go to Thailand and speaking to some of the monks, it's really, it's not easy to do, but there's today. So yesterday's gone, tomorrow's not here. So if you can live today, which would be fantastic for everyone if I do, but, you know, there's bills to pay and there's house payment, there's people to look after. The closer you can get to that point where you live today for today, it makes life. We make our own misery, we make our own sorrow, we make all this happen because we want things, we want to know, we want to have. I'm finding the less I want, the less that I get upset about not having, the better off I feel inside. It's yeah, I'd like, I want a new car, or I want to be able to do this. To reduce that wanting of anything, it's hard to do. We're human. We're brought up in a certain culture. We've learned a habit from when we were born in the families we were in. But the more you meditate on it, or the more you consider it, the more mindful you are about different things, it makes sense. It's very difficult to do, especially when there's other people involved, family, brothers, sisters, mothers, fathers, daughters. But, yeah, what can I say? You know, I'm trying to do what I can do for me as well as for my family.
And how are Ned and band going with that? Do they have a similar philosophy or are they on a...
Yeah, I think it's difficult to... We don't get together and sit down and have family meetings and discuss where we're going. We know what's going on. I know what Nid's doing. Bang's living her life and realising, you know, some things are more important than other things. She's going through a stage now, trying everything, give everything a go. You know, when is it? If I'm too busy and I might not get to try something, you know, might, you know, learn guitar, do some drawing, do some meditation, whatever. Yeah, there's always the sisters missing, our daughter's missing, but you've still got to keep moving forward. You've still got to keep centering yourself and remember we're here for ourselves as well as everyone else. And it's easy to forget yourself and get involved in, you know, somebody else's problem, whatever problem it is. So I think we're all doing fairly well for what, you know, for what we are. We're all going along quite well. And realistically, we are here for a certain amount of time and you know, we can do what we can.
I'm just in awe of your ability to think like that. It's very impressive. Because this does impact the people left behind more than anyone would ever understand. Are there ways in which your life has changed because of Bung's disappearance that people wouldn't expect that you can think of?
Changed. Yeah, well, probably a lot of plans have changed. Living in limbo, feeling like your hands are tied sometimes, you can't go anywhere because you've got to be here to do this and stay in the family home. Thinking about how the world is, you know, the world's a good place, but it's not too. Sort of get disappointed in what's, what is possible in this planet, you know. We're all here trying to do something, but we get caught up in different scenarios and different situations. So, yeah, it probably has changed my life quite a bit. I don't laugh and smile and carry on as much as I used to, which is a bit of a shame, but I'm trying to work through that. Trying to get re-involved in life and society and hobbies and things has taken a hit, you know. I work, I make money, I support the family. So it's just me, the way I am dealing with it. Recently, mother passed away, so I had to deal with that, and sort of it was me and the brother and sister that were the control of that. I've got a lot of brothers and sisters, but they all couldn't stand up for that, so we couldn't stand up for that. So that took time away from thinking about problems again, focused on that. So, yeah, I think getting back to focusing on what I want to do a bit more is something that I have lost over the last 8 years. But I'm getting around it, getting over that and hopefully getting better at it.
Do you not want to leave the house in case one comes back?
Not so much leave the house. I don't mind going away, but to actually plan and follow through plans that we had made when Bung was around, to get them through school, retire, go and live overseas, has been not in the front of the thoughts, but in the back of the thoughts, you know, this is the place she knows. This is sort of the home base. But how long do we have to hold on to that one thing? So, yeah, it has been an issue, but I'm sort of, I don't know, as I say, getting better at dealing with things.
That's so tough, I think, that house connection, because, I mean, you've raised Bung since she was 6 years old and that was the home that she was raised in from six
House? We were in a unit for a year or so before that, then we got a place. So.
But otherwise, that's a lot of years in that home.
It's in that home, and it's also the home that's driven the family apart, driven my wife away. So it's the double-edged sword.
I can't even fathom how difficult that is, Fred. So Nid went back to Thailand after a year or so.
From memory, I think it was about 6 months, a year. So it was, it, after the first initial month of me being off work, I went back to work. So then she was at home by herself, and it was maybe even 2 or 3 months after everything happened that she went back. She's come back a few times on holidays, but never lasts. She was here this year, supposed to stay until I was going back on holidays. Lasted 2 weeks, and it was enough. So she was back again. So it's very difficult for her to be around us. When we were here living as a family, walking around the streets, all the area, we knew everything everywhere.
That's so tough on both of you, and that you're left there while she's away, and knowing that when she does come to visit, it's going to be especially difficult for her. And
yeah, it's not the right thing, but sometimes it's easier for her to be over there than me have her here together, because when she's here, we're both, I've got to direct more attention and feel that I have to take care more than when she's in her home circle, and she's got her things, she's got her car, she's got her, friends, her networks. Over here, she's more isolated because of the way the situations are and getting around, and just lifestyle just so different. So it doesn't make it easy, but yeah, I think sometimes it's easier if we're not together. And after so many years, we know time flies, it goes quick. The years are going down over and over quick. So, and there's always, FaceTime and Messenger. So we talk to each other most days and see each other most days. It's just like you're away at work.
Isolation is real, I think, when you find yourself in this spot where no one really understands what you're going through. So people don't know what to say. I mean, we're not good at speaking about a standard loss like death, let alone a complicated loss like a missing person. Yeah. So how have you found people respond? Even close friends, like they don't have the language, they don't know what to say. Did you feel especially socially isolated? Like how have people broached that with you?
Yeah, you find people don't know what to say or when to say it, or they dodge around the subject, or, I think I've had probably longer conversations with people that I don't know and just a complete stranger, and we've had a chat and had a talk about what's going on and things like that. There's no expectations. There's, I know, they'll know the story. And how you going? A couple of friends have been good about it, ask what they can do, close friends. But, a lot of people skirt around it once they know who I am or who we are, and it's not something, a subject they bring up. But then there has been a couple of different reactions, I guess, to the situation. And yeah, you're right, people don't know how to talk about it, people don't know how to bring up a subject, and everyone's got different lifestyles, everyone's got different experiences in life, not everyone's come from a split family, or some people have been in a constant life family and things. So there's a whole lot of different things. So, yeah, there has been a lot of different responses. Lately I still have people ask me, friends, mate, how's things going? Have you heard anything? I'm sorry to hear the story. But
do you prefer when people do bring it up and ask about Bung and talk about Bung, or is it so hard that you prefer not to have it raised?
Yeah, well, it depends too. Sometimes you just want to have a chat, talk about it. If somebody wants to ask, I'm not embarrassed or not anguished about them asking me how things are going. Sometimes it's better if someone asks, because I at least know someone's still thinking, someone that's still they haven't forgotten. People still remember what happened. So it's part of an acceptance that I've had to deal with. I've had to accept it. I can't change the fact that she's not around. And there's no use saying, well, I don't want to talk about it, because it's the way it is.
Well, some people, and understandably, aren't like that. And men in particular, yeah. And men of a certain vintage in particular.
Yeah.
So it is really good that you do take the opportunity and speak about Bung. And
well, as I say, it helps me as well. Mm. As I say, I don't get out and do the social things I used to do all the time. I don't, you know, have all that sort of thing. Now I've concentrated a lot on working and staying busy and not going out. But, so every now and again it does help.
Do you sometimes visualise what your life would have been like at this point or in the future had all of this not happened? Or
no. Every stage of my life has been a major event change there somewhere along the line. You know, being brought up without a father and finding him after so many, you know, a lot of years and things like that. So it's always been some major drama. And there's always been a major turn when something happens. Well, I've got a plan to do this and then I get married, or a plan to do this, then that falls through and I've got to go another direction. So the change of direction is quite radical when it does happen. It seems to have been happening my whole life. So.
Okay, so you may have been, better equipped to deal with that kind of change and adapt better than others might have been able to. Mm. I've got another uncomfortable topic to raise, but we talked about it earlier. Do you think that the response from the public or the police or the media would have been different if Bung was white?
That's a hard question. I don't know. As I say, everybody who met Bung loved Bung. And she's Thai, not white, Caucasian, or not African-American or whatever. I don't know if that would have been a different response from media or would have stood out more if she was, you know. She was living as an Australian student with an Australian family. So at the time, I don't think the media or anything sort of was brushed aside because she wasn't born in here. I don't think there was that much of a difference at the time with her being Thai. At Maeve, I didn't really pick up on anything like that. I didn't. As for the police, they were professional. They did their job the way they do it. They didn't care either.
That's good. I think a lot of families do worry, and there's a sense of in different categories, like children or women or whatever the type of missing person is, there's a, you know, that there can be a feeling of competition and, you know, well, why is that family getting more attention than mine? You know, we've both got loved ones of a similar, you know, whatever the demographic is, and we're not getting as much or enough. And it's good that you don't feel that that has been an issue for you. I know a lot of families do worry that that can affect the spread of awareness for their loved one.
We were very happy that at the start the task force was set up relatively quickly. I think it was within a week of the whole thing coming out and everything that was taken over by the homicide squad, and there was a dedicated task force set up to find, because it was so out of character, this young girl, you know, that was 13. I don't know if that could have been done quicker legally or, you know, logistically or whatever. I don't think we got any special control or help, but it would be nice if everyone in that situation could have that sort of response. As I say, there's a lot of things, papers, money's never enough for the force. They'll complain that there's never enough supplies. There's everything's about the dollar at the end of the day in this country, and some things shouldn't be that way.
Another step and process that unfortunately families in this situation have to come up against over a period of time generally is the coronial process. I'm not sure what the status is with Bung, but has that come up in your
search? That's been spoken of before, the coronial inquest. The detectives still aren't at a position or at a point where they want to go down that track. That, the way I understand it, that's sort of the final finale investigation. They go, so go over everything that they're going over, that they're still going over. So that is something that will come, or if it comes, when it needs to come. Like I say, it's at the moment, it's still an open investigation. There's still a reward. There's still money on the table for someone to come forward. There's still options. There's still some sort of information dribbling in the coronial, and I'm not 100% over the top of all that, what that's all about, but I've asked about that and been told that we're not at that point yet. So,
is that a relief?
Yes, that's a relief, because that means they're still actively involved in investigating it and trying to find. I think if they get to a point where they say, right, but as I say, I'm not sure, if that comes up, then what's that mean? Is that sort of like the end of the investigation, or is it that the, I don't know,
It's really unclear. I don't even know myself.
Yeah, I haven't talked about it with family, and I haven't even thought about it, honestly.
I think there is that feeling that signifies the end. However, at the same time, police say no until they're found. It's still ongoing.
Open.
Exactly.
It's still an open book. Hasn't been shut and put away.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I don't think they're at that point yet, or they haven't mentioned it.
Yeah. I mean, every case is different. I know that William Tyrrell's case has already begun the coronial inquest process, and then he's been missing just over 5 years now, I think. But it's always, depends on, there are so many variables. You mentioned that there is still a reward. How much is the reward?
It's $1 million.
$1 million.
Yeah.
How was it when they announced that for you guys?
That was good, yeah. Yeah, we thought it could have come earlier, but it doesn't seem to have changed anything. I don't think they got any new or information about it. It was sort of a bright spark in the processes, and $1 million, maybe we'll get some sort of information come forward. So it was good at the start, but then when nothing comes through, then you thought, it's still there. Well, hopefully, you come up with all these different scenarios. Well, there's $1 million there. Someone who knows something will say, well, start talking rather than sitting back and knowing what we know and not saying anything. But obviously that hasn't happened, so.
Not yet. Did you feel that it showed that your daughter was valued more by the police, by the state, by the people? What's the notion like for a parent when there is a reward? Because many families don't have rewards for their missing children.
Valued. She was valued more. That's a funny question.
It's weird. Sorry if it's offensive, but you know what I mean? Coming from the point of the public and other families, for instance, that don't have a reward yet, they feel that their child isn't as highly regarded or whatever the terminology is. But
I really haven't thought about sort of that. I was glad that it came out, and, if I had the money, I'd double it, and the money wouldn't be an option. Why it doesn't happen to everyone? It's the legal system. Everybody should have the right and the ability to have this sort of incentive for people to come forward. There's a lot of stuff that goes on in the background of police. There's a lot of stuff that goes back at politics and corporate things and everything. So, it was good news that it did happen, but as I say, it hasn't changed anything. So,
how long has it been since it was announced now?
At least 4 years, maybe 8 years she's gone, so maybe even longer. It was about 3 years into it. Maybe they brought it up. It was pretty early on in the case.
About hope and that example that you just touched on, when they did decide that they were going to announce a reward for information leading to Bung, how did you guys feel afterwards? Do you feel like, because it is, there's such a letdown when no one comes forward and you're waiting and you're hoping and then still nothing's changed. then do you look back on that feeling of hope and go, I wish I hadn't, you know, is it such a letdown, that false hope? Or do you look back and go, I'm glad at least I got to have a feeling of hope, that spark for a day or a week or a month, you know, in the immediate aftermath of the announcement? How do you feel about that?
I don't think we've thought about that much at all. I know I haven't. I did for a while. But as I say, I don't dwell on all these what ifs and, you know, why this happened and why this didn't happen. It's a hard question to answer.
Fair enough. No need to answer. Yeah. Everyone's different. I mean, I know that because hope is such a central theme to this context of missingness, that families have a different, you know, way of managing their hope, because if you do get your hopes up when you have a media opportunity or there isn't a reward announcement or whatever it is, then the letdown can be, you know, enormous. Ruin you.
Yeah.
And then you kind of start to resent hope and you don't want to hope and you want to let go of hope, but then letting go, then you've got to deal with guilt. You know, it's a complicated situation.
It's an up and down, up and down. That's why we believe it's sort of better to stay in the middle, not get this super high excitement and then the very low downs that nothing's happened. The roller coaster is just too intense. And our beliefs and our learnings in lives that we've got to so far is the middle line is a lot better and a lot easier to deal with. Okay, something good might happen, but if it doesn't, I'm not going to crash down until, you know, maybe that'll change in the future. I don't know. I can't see what's happening in the future, but I can work with what I'm dealing with now and how I deal with things now. So it's, hope is a funny word. It's a funny thing to have. It's beliefs are a funny thing. They're personal. I would want to see her again. I wish I'll see her again. But if I don't see her again, it's, you know, there'll be another time. You know? But yeah, we try not to, as I say, dwell on it and think on those sorts of lines as much as, yeah, I don't know what's normal. You know? I deal with it the way we deal with it. We deal with it that way. Yeah. My wife maybe dealing with it differently, but she hasn't told me any different. You know, she does what she does, and we don't live in each other's pockets all the time. So, but we do have a connection of emotions when we, you know, have a trouble or have problems. We deal with it then. So.
You're a wonderful father and a wonderful husband.
Thank you.
I'm so sorry that you're still living this.
It's good to hear, and it's good to get reconfirmation of what I'm doing is something worthwhile.
Absolutely. Beyond measure. The way that you are advocating for your daughter and representing your family is really beautiful. It's very special. Was there anything else that you wanted to touch on?
No, nothing more than what we've been over every other meeting. You know, if this gets out to somebody who knows what's going on, if this gets out to somebody who has some sort of idea of what's happened or is happening, or please, it's time to give us all a bit of rest and come forward and say something. Friends of friends, rumours of people, there's nothing too small. People have dreams or think they remember something. Yeah. Don't keep it to yourself. And this is an ongoing thing. And as I say, it doesn't get any easier, but it's easier to deal with. We grow these skills and things to deal with things, but it's ongoing and it's going to be until we see something. So, yeah, if anyone out there knows anything, just come forward.
You just never know where it's going to go.
Well, that's it. You know, it's one of the five points of separation or something between you and anyone.
Have you had, sorry, I've just had a thought around hoaxes. I'm sure you've had plenty. I know I've read media about some of them. What's your experience been like with weirdos coming out with all sorts of stories?
We haven't had a lot of that. We've been pretty lucky with that, I think. Back in the day, there was one of the school, say, friends, one of her school, the same era, had come forward with a story that someone tried to grab her and it was all just an attention thing. It was never happened and things like that. So that was rough at the start. As I've had people knock on the door, and quite surprisingly, a guy from the other side of town, and he'd been investigating the case as long as the police, and he had a dossier of photos and ideas and theories and Google Map sightings and things like that. And he's come in and shown me this, and he's given this information to police as well. And so it's all been involved, but people coming out of nowhere and saying, I'm so-and-so and this is what I've done, I hope I haven't overstepped the ground or something like that, which at the start was like, that's a bit odd, but it's been looked at and hopefully it's helping somewhere along the line. There's still, you know, people out there that are interested. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, you can take it one way or another, but, yeah, it was a bit of a shock at the start, but I've been in contact with him a couple of times and he's fully open and fully accessible to people that need to be. So
it is a fine line, isn't it? Because you kind of, it's encouraging to see that total strangers care, but then sometimes they get a little bit too involved and have very strong ideas or feelings. There are lots of charlatans around that, you know, maybe genuinely do want to help and do believe that they have maybe psychic abilities. But for the families, it's pretty hurtful.
Yeah, well, way back at the beginning, there was a couple of guys in the city that were a bit like that, convinced that there was the Mr. Krull was involved and, you know, we visited them and spoke with them and stuff like that. So there was quite a lot of things going on there. He was very secretive about what he wanted to let know and what to go. And so we've been through all that. We've dealt with a lot of different, an ex-Indian Army general. Went through some of the stuff that they used to do to find people as well. And so there's been a whole lot of different ways that we've looked and tried to find. And
you've got to stay open to these things. You can't rule anything out because you're desperate and you're vulnerable and you need to know where your child is. So you do go along and it leads to some pretty colourful characters and strange experiences.
Yes, it's true.
But just adds to the absolute exhaustion of it all. This is an enormous task. And again, I'm just so sorry that you're still in the thick of it.
Yeah. Thanks for that. It's, as I say, it is what it is and we'll deal with what we do and take day by day. You know?
Here is Bung. She's heading out the door to school. Her mum made chicken curry soup and rice for breakfast and Bung has the leftovers packed in her backpack for lunch. She doesn't like the stuff they serve at the canteen. It's cold, so she wears a rain jacket over her blue and white striped uniform. Bye, Mum, she says. See you later. The birds overhead don't mind that it's cold and grey. Magpies warble in the gums, and there's an occasional squawk from a cockatoo. Traffic rumbles nearby as commuters make their way to work. School is just down the road. The future is a step out the front door, and anything is possible. Here is Bung. Bung Siriboon's episode was adapted from original writing by Lily Wilkinson. Missing Persons Advocacy Network is an unfunded charity run by me, Lauren O'Keefe. In 2016, we started a project that paired authors and artists with Australian families to tell their stories, to humanise missing loved ones beyond the stats they're typically reduced to. Though it grew to comprise murals, songs, sculptures, documentaries and coffee cups, our modern take on the old milk carton campaigns of the 80s, it began with a book called Two Short Stories. The What's Missing podcast was inspired by that book. These stories are but some of thousands. Help us help the usually unseen, unheard, forgotten community of those left behind by heading to our website where you can donate or get involved. mpan.com.au. That's mpan.com.au. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter using the same handle, mpanaus. That's mpanaus. If you have a missing loved one, check out our guide at missingpersonsguide.com.